They called it the Golden Tide. But for Caribbean nations, it's a toxic invader. In May and June 2025, over 38 million metric tons of sargassum seaweed swamped coastlines from Puerto Rico to Barbados, devastating marine life, forcing school closures, and choking tourism with its sulfurous stench. This isn't just an environmental issue. It's a crisis of climate change, coastal survival, and the resilience of Caribbean communities pushed to the brink and fighting back with science, spirit, and seaweed. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. The brown tide returns. It began again, like it always does, silently. No alarms, no news flashes, just a faint rustle in the waves and a change in the scent of the breeze. By mid-May 2025, something vast and golden brown had begun creeping across the Caribbean Sea. From space, satellites captured the bloom, a serpentine band stretching for hundreds of miles, moving steadily toward the turquoise coastlines of the Antilles, the Yucatan Peninsula, and the Windward Islands. But to the millions who live along those shores, it wasn't just a satellite image. It was a warning. By the time the first piles of sargassum seaweed hit the beaches of Barbados, St. Lucia, and the Dominican Republic, it was already too late. The cleanup crews were overwhelmed within hours. Resorts closed entire sections of beach. Tourists canceled bookings en masse. The smell, thick, sulfuric, and almost metallic, settled over coastal towns like a toxic fog. Local fishermen in Puerto Rico described it as a carpet of death. Children in Martinique were pulled out of school as air quality deteriorated. Hotels across the Mexican Caribbean put up privacy fences to hide the growing mounds of rotting seaweed from guests. But social media was already saturated with drone footage of brown tide-covered shorelines, tourists gagging behind masks, and bulldozers scraping tons of biomass into trucks. According to the University of South Florida's Optical Oceanography Lab, this year's bloom was not just another seasonal surge. It was the largest ever recorded, 38 million metric tons of sargassum, stretching from West Africa to the Caribbean Sea in a belt so massive it's now visible year-round. But what exactly is it? And why is it growing so fast, year after year? This was not always the case. For centuries, sargassum was a quiet wanderer of the open ocean, floating in the North Atlantic's Sargasso Sea, where it provided a unique habitat for marine life. But today, it has morphed into an environmental invader, choking ecosystems, burying coastlines, and becoming one of the most visible signs of the Caribbean's unfolding climate crisis. The 2025 sargassum invasion was no longer just a seasonal inconvenience. It became a national emergency, with governments scrambling to declare disaster zones, import special equipment, and issue health warnings to coastal populations. Entire economies trembled. The tourism sector, still recovering from COVID-era losses, watched helplessly as their most valuable asset, clean, beautiful beaches, disappeared under the sludge. But this chapter isn't just about the physical invasion. It's about the emotional toll, the economic aftershock, and the ecological trauma now unfolding in real time. In Belize, marine biologists found thousands of juvenile fish dead in the shallows. In Guadeloupe, sea turtle nesting grounds were buried before hatchlings could emerge. And in St. Vincent, entire coastal villages began debating whether to stay or relocate, because the smell alone had made everyday life unbearable. As the brown tide surged inland, so did frustration. Why did this happen again? Why were communities left without equipment, without funding, without warning? And why, despite years of scientific reporting and mounting evidence, is the world only now beginning to pay attention? In the next chapter, we'll uncover the science. What exactly is sargassum? Where does it come from? And how did this once beneficial ocean drifter become one of the Caribbean's most urgent environmental threats? But for now, we stay on the shore, with the families raking seaweed by hand, the hoteliers losing income by the hour, and the children asking their parents why they can't go to the beach anymore. This is not the beginning of a seaweed bloom. It's the continuation of a battle for the soul of the Caribbean coast. Where it comes from, and why it's getting worse. To understand the sargassum crisis, you must first understand its name, a word whispered in panic across beachfront villages and tourist boardrooms. Sargassum, a floating brown algae, born not from coastal waters, but from the vast, swirling wilderness of the North Atlantic Ocean. It originates in the Sargasso Sea, a place unlike any other on Earth. A sea without shores, bordered not by land, but by the Atlantic's major currents. Here, in these nutrient-poor waters, patches of sargassum once thrived. Harmless, even helpful, forming floating mats that served as nurseries for sea turtles, eels, and fish. Sailors of old wrote poetry about the calm, golden slicks that stretched across the ocean like braided hair. But that sargassum is not the one smothering the Caribbean today. In the early 2010s, scientists began noticing a shift. Satellite images showed massive blooms forming far south of the Sargasso Sea, along a new belt stretching from West Africa to Brazil, curving across the Atlantic and into the Caribbean basin. This area became known as the Great Atlantic Sargassum Belt, and it has grown exponentially every year since. So what changed? The answer, like the seaweed itself, is tangled. At the heart of this bloom is a combination of climate change, nutrient pollution, and disrupted ocean currents. Let's begin with runoff. Vast rivers like the Amazon, Congo, and Mississippi now carry massive loads of fertilizers, sewage, and industrial waste from agriculture and urban sprawl. These nutrients, particularly nitrogen and phosphorus, act like steroids for algae. What used to be a sparse patch of floating seaweed has turned into an unstoppable, nutrient-gorged monster. Next, warming waters. As ocean temperatures rise due to climate change, the growing season for sargassum extends. Where it once died off with seasonal shifts, it now blooms nearly year-round, thickening, expanding, and following trade winds directly into the Caribbean. Then there's deforestation, especially in the Amazon. Without forests to anchor the soil, heavy rains flush more sediment and nutrients into the ocean. The result? A vast, open buffet for sargassum, and an accelerated life cycle that the Caribbean cannot control. It's important to understand that this isn't the same sargassum we once knew. Scientists have confirmed that the species invading Caribbean coasts is genetically distinct from its older, more stable northern cousin. This variant grows faster, survives longer, and thrives in polluted waters. It is, in many ways, a biological warning, a symptom of a planet under strain. But for island nations, this isn't just about the science. It's about survival. In interviews with researchers from the University of the West Indies and NASA's Ocean Biology Division, the message is clear. The Caribbean is bearing the brunt of a global problem it did not create. Sargassum blooms are fueled by industrial practices thousands of miles away. Yet it's Caribbean fishermen, hoteliers, schoolchildren, and marine ecosystems paying the price. A toxic irony unfolds. Global agricultural industries feed the world. And in the process, they poison the ocean. Small island nations, barely contributing to global emissions or fertilizer overuse, are left to clean up the mess, with limited resources, underfunded ministries, and rising public anger. In Barbados, environmental scientists warn that the island's already fragile coral systems are reaching a tipping point. In Honduras, local fishermen say they now spend more time cutting through seaweed than actually fishing. And in Trinidad and Tobago, the seaweed is becoming a political issue, with accusations of negligence and corruption surrounding delayed cleanups. Still, amidst the crisis, knowledge is growing. Remote sensing satellites, drone tracking, and sea current modeling are giving scientists new tools to forecast sargassum surges, sometimes weeks in advance. But forecasting is not prevention. The bloom keeps returning, bigger, thicker, more toxic than before. In the next chapter, we shift focus to the people who feel this invasion most directly. The workers, the business owners, the families trying to survive. Because the next truth we must confront is this. The brown tide isn't just burying beaches. It's burying economies. Tourism on life support. At first, they tried to hide it. In the early days of the bloom, before the sulfur stench had settled and the headlines began to circle, some resorts attempted a strategy of silence. They moved beach chairs inland. They fenced off seaweed-covered sections. They edited their photos and replaced beachfront shots with poolside glamour. But nature, as always, refused to cooperate. By the end of May 2025, tourism across the Caribbean was under siege. From the Riviera Maya in Mexico to the southern coast of Jamaica, the impact was undeniable. Beaches that once drew honeymooners and sunseekers were now carpeted in decaying sargassum, steaming under the tropical sun, excreting noxious hydrogen sulfide, and driving guests back inside with watering eyes and nausea. And the reviews followed. TripAdvisor and Google reviews became battlegrounds. Guests posted photos of brown, murky waters. Others uploaded videos of tractors hauling tons of seaweed off the sand at dawn. One review from a resort in Punta Cana read simply, "Beautiful hotel. Couldn't use the beach. Smelled like rotten eggs the whole trip. Would not return." The numbers confirmed the reality. Tourism boards across St. Lucia, Barbados, Puerto Rico, and the Dominican Republic reported drops in booking rates between 15% and 40% within just 3 weeks. And it wasn't just the luxury chains. Small goose houses, beachfront restaurants, snorkeling tours. The entire coastal economy began to suffocate alongside the reefs. In Tulum, where eco-luxury meets Instagram aesthetics, yoga instructors and boutique hoteliers voiced quiet panic. "We rely on the water," said Maya, a co-owner of a beachfront retreat. "The sound, the smell, the image, it's our brand. When that's gone, we're not just losing revenue. We're losing identity." The ripple effect was brutal. In St. Kitts, catamaran companies reported an 80% reduction in bookings. In Martinique, a popular family-run seafood shack had to shut down for health reasons. The fumes from the decomposing seaweed were making the staff ill. Even major cruise lines began issuing advisories, rerouting ships away from severely affected ports. The economic fallout was immediate and uneven. Big hotel chains with international backing managed to install barriers, hire extra cleanup crews, and compensate guests with coupons or free excursions. But local entrepreneurs, already burdened by inflation, supply chain shocks, and post-COVID recovery, were not so lucky. "They expect us to absorb this," said Jean-Paul, a beach vendor in Guadeloupe. "But how do I sell coconuts on a beach that smells like sewage?" The Caribbean tourism industry is a lifeline for millions, accounting for up to 40% of GDP in some island nations. And yet, in the face of this ecological disaster, support was patchy at best. Many national governments, stretched thin, offered modest grants or short-term cleanup subsidies. But with no long-term plan and no international disaster designation, the burden fell once again on the same shoulders. The workers, the fishermen, the local communities. Some tried to fight back. In Barbados, hotel associations formed emergency coalitions, pooling funds to hire marine barriers and offshore skimmers. In Dominica, tourism boards invested in inland excursions and mountain hikes to offset beach losses. And across the Lesser Antilles, youth volunteers donned gloves and masks, joining local cleanup brigades in the early morning sun. Not for money, but for pride. But nothing could erase the larger question echoing across island nations. What happens when paradise becomes unlivable? Because this isn't just a tourism story. It's a climate story, a justice story, and a crisis of regional dependence on an industry forever at the mercy of rising seas, warming waters, and ecological instability. And this summer, that instability took the form of a monster, thick, brown, and relentless. In the next chapter, we'll turn away from the beach and into the communities, where the threat becomes even more personal. Because the real danger isn't just what sargassum does to the water. It's what it releases into the air we breathe. Toxic air and public health. You don't see it at first. Not like the thick, brown piles on the sand. Not like the headlines warning of closed beaches and ruined vacations. But the air tells another story. When sargassum seaweed washes ashore, it begins a rapid decomposition process. Within hours, heat and bacteria begin breaking down its tangled mass. And with this decomposition comes a gas, invisible, corrosive, and dangerous. Hydrogen sulfide, or H2S. To some, it's just a foul odor, a heavy, choking scent often compared to rotten eggs or sewage. But to health professionals across the Caribbean, it's now considered a public health emergency. At low concentrations, hydrogen sulfide causes headaches, dizziness, burning eyes, and nausea. But as the bloom thickens and exposure lengthens, symptoms intensify. Persistent coughing, asthma flare-ups, difficulty breathing, fatigue, even neurological issues. In Martinique, it became too much. By mid-June 2025, several schools were forced to close as children reported mass illness, fainting, and respiratory distress. A teacher in Fort de France described the scene. "We were in the middle of a lesson when 5 students began vomiting. Some were crying from the pain in their chests. It was like poison in the air. In Guadeloupe, hospital admissions surged in coastal towns. Elderly residents and young children were most vulnerable. Local health departments issued advisories urging people to stay indoors, wear masks, and avoid strenuous activity near the shore. But for many, that wasn't an option. Fishermen still needed to fish, vendors still needed to sell, and communities built right along the water, generations of families, had nowhere else to go. In Belize, rural health clinics began documenting what they called brown tide illness, clusters of symptoms among residents near affected zones, with no other cause but prolonged exposure to sargassum decay. One mother, Marissa, shared her story in tears. "My son started coughing last year when the seaweed came. We took him to doctors, gave him medication, cleaned the house every day. But it never stopped. The cough only goes away when we visit my sister inland. Then it comes back the moment we return home." The economic inequality of the crisis was further exposed. Luxury resorts installed air filtration systems, moved guests inland, or shuttled them to unaffected zones. But public schools, community centers, and clinics often had no resources to protect the populations most at risk. In Haiti, where healthcare infrastructure was already fragile, the issue became dire. Reports from Jacmel and Les Cays described children sleeping in rooms with towels stuffed under doors to block the smell, yet still waking up coughing. Scientists from the Caribbean Public Health Agency, CARFA, began issuing stark warnings. Prolonged exposure to hydrogen sulfide, even at low levels, could increase long-term health risks, especially for children, the elderly, and pregnant women. The cumulative effect of years of exposure was unknown, but likely to be devastating. Meanwhile, governments scrambled. Some declared health emergencies. Others distributed masks, funded awareness campaigns, or began installing air monitors near schools. But for many islanders, it felt like too little too late. Why weren't these measures in place years ago? Why weren't international bodies treating this like the environmental health crisis it is? As public frustration grew, some communities took matters into their own hands. In St. Lucia, a coalition of mothers began organizing safe air zones in community buildings, using donated fans, vinegar bowls, and open-source air filters. In Jamaica, a youth tech group developed a low-cost hydrogen sulfide detector and began distributing it to households. Innovation born of desperation. Health defense built from solidarity. But every effort comes with a question that no government, no expert, and no organization has yet answered. How do we protect ourselves from a future that keeps washing ashore? Because this isn't just a coastal issue anymore. It's in the lungs. It's in the schools. It's in the silence of parents who can't explain why their children are always sick. In the next chapter, we return to the shoreline. Not to the people this time, but to the sea itself. To the turtles that cannot nest. To the fish that cannot breathe. To the reefs now gasping for light beneath the shadow of a crisis no one asked for. Because the sargassum seaweed invasion is not just killing livelihoods. It's killing life itself. Ecological dominoes. Before the tourists, before the beachfront hotels and cruise ports, the Caribbean was, and still is, a cradle of biodiversity. Shallow coral reefs teeming with color. Seagrass beds dancing beneath translucent waves. Mangrove forests, nesting sea turtles, and hidden fish nurseries pulsing with life. But now, these ancient ecosystems are under siege. The sargassum seaweed doesn't just invade the surface. It suffocates the very lungs of the Caribbean Sea. When thick mats of sargassum float offshore, they block sunlight from reaching below. Coral reefs, already battling bleaching, warming, and acidification, begin to die off faster under this layer of darkness. Seagrass beds, which serve as vital feeding grounds for manatees, conchs, and juvenile fish, quickly wither. Without light, there is no photosynthesis. Without photosynthesis, there is no oxygen. And without oxygen, the sea begins to die. Underwater, hypoxic zones, also known as dead zones, begin to form. Entire swaths of coastline become uninhabitable for marine life. Fish flee. Crabs drown in low-oxygen pockets. Microbial blooms flourish in their absence, destabilizing food chains and water chemistry. But some creatures can't flee. They're born on the beach. Every year, from April through September, thousands of endangered sea turtles crawl ashore to lay their eggs on the soft, white sands of the Caribbean. But in 2025, many of those beaches were blanketed by thick sargassum banks, sometimes piled several feet high. in Barbuda, nesting surveys recorded a 70% drop in successful hatchings. In Tobago, baby turtles were spotted trapped beneath layers of seaweed, disoriented and exhausted, never reaching the sea. Dr. Kiana Ramsey, a marine biologist in St. Kitts, described it like this. The turtles come up, but there's no sand, just rotting seaweed. The females turn back. Some lay eggs on top of the sargassum, where they cook in the sun or get swept away. Hatchlings that do emerge are confused. They crawl toward the heat of the decomposing mass instead of the moonlit sea. And they die. Mangroves, too, are in danger. These tangled forests, the guardians of the shoreline, depend on a delicate balance of salt water and oxygen-rich sediment. But when sargassum accumulates in coastal estuaries, it rots slowly and deeply. Its acidic runoff seeps into the mangrove root systems, triggering decay. The result? Coastal erosion accelerates. Fish nurseries vanish. And storm resistance, one of the mangrove's most critical roles, is lost. In Grenada, drone footage captured entire mangrove stretches turning black and brittle. In Haiti, community fishermen began documenting fish die-offs along traditional traps and shallow bays that had once teemed with juvenile snapper. And then there are the invisible victims, birds that rely on healthy reef fish for food, sharks and rays who lose access to shallow hunting grounds, planktonic species suffocated by disrupted oxygen levels. What we are witnessing is not just a beach problem. It is the slow unraveling of a marine web built over millennia. Yet the world remains largely unaware. Because ecosystems die in silence. They collapse quietly, with no protest signs or press conferences. Only the absence remains. The reef that no longer glows, the bay that no longer hums, the bird that never returns. This is the price of neglect. Of thinking that brown seaweed is just a cosmetic inconvenience. Of treating the Caribbean as a vacation brochure rather than a living biome. But amidst the damage, there are defenders. In Belize, marine patrol teams now use thermal drones to locate blocked turtle nesting zones at night, manually clearing paths for hatchlings. In Dominica, reef restoration projects are racing against time, trying to reinforce coral nurseries before the next bloom arrives. And in St. Vincent, mangrove replanting programs are shifting inland, anticipating future coastal dieback. Still, no local effort can fully stop the collapse if the global forces fueling this crisis, warming waters, deforestation, chemical runoff, remain unchecked. In the next chapter, we'll meet the people on the front lines of that effort. From bulldozer crews to biotech startups, from volunteers to eco-warriors, we'll explore the fight to reclaim the beaches, clean the waters, and turn back the tide. Because if the ecology is falling apart, then what's truly on the line is the survival of the Caribbean itself. The cleanup war. By the time the first cleanup trucks arrived, the damage had already begun to settle deep. Not just into the sand, but into the air, the economy, and the spirit of the coast. The sargassum seaweed invasion is not a one-day disaster. It's not a storm that passes. It's a slow-motion war. One that returns every year, heavier, smellier, and more destructive. And the cleanup? It's not just about rakes and shovels. It's about infrastructure, politics, innovation, and survival. In Barbados, where the seaweed began arriving in late April 2025, crews worked day and night, bulldozing, dumping, burning. Some beaches were cleared in 48 hours, only to be buried again days later. In Mexico, along the tourism-dependent stretch between Cancun and Playa del Carmen, massive beach cleaning machines patrolled the shore like mechanical insects, collecting tons of seaweed and hauling it away by truck. Yet still, the shore turned brown again. The numbers are staggering. In a single month, Jamaica's tourism ministry reported spending $3.4 million USD on sargassum removal. Dominican Republic's Hotel Association estimated that cleanup efforts, coupled with lost revenue, cost the industry over $12 million US dollars in just 6 weeks. And this is just surface-level cleanup. The real nightmare unfolds in the logistics. Where do you put 100,000 pounds of rotting biomass? How do you dispose of it without poisoning groundwater or stinking up inland communities? Do you bury it? Burn it? Compost it? The answers vary, and none are perfect. In Martinique, improper dumping led to complaints of contamination near residential zones. In St. Lucia, experiments with composting sargassum failed after locals reported the soil retained the seaweed's pungent smell. And in Trinidad, a landfill caught fire after dried sargassum ignited under the Caribbean sun. The war for clean beaches has created two classes of response. The well-funded industrial efforts, backed by government ministries and foreign investors. The local DIY movements, organized by communities with passion but little money. In Grenada, villagers used wheelbarrows, buckets, and sheer determination to keep their fishing docks clear. In Antigua, schoolchildren joined weekly seaweed brigades, filling trash bags with seaweed before it could rot. One teen, Malik, summed it up best. We're not waiting for someone to save our beaches. If we don't do it, no one will. But there's also a third front emerging, innovation. Across the region, a new generation of scientists and entrepreneurs are asking a radical question. Can we transform the crisis into an opportunity? In Belize, a biotech startup called Algene Caribbean is testing ways to convert sargassum into biodegradable plastic alternatives. In Barbados, researchers are developing sargassum-based bricks that could one day be used in hurricane-resistant housing. And in Guadeloupe, pilot programs are exploring biofuel conversion, extracting methane from rotting seaweed to power generators and community microgrids. Still, the race is uphill. Funding remains scarce. Technology needs scaling. And resistance is real. Some farmers, for instance, fear that sargassum compost could contain arsenic or heavy metals from ocean runoff. Meanwhile, calls are growing louder for regional unity. Environmental leaders from CARICOM, OECS, and UNEP Caribbean are urging for a cross-island emergency fund, joint research hubs, and bulk purchasing of seaweed barriers and cleanup machinery. Because if one island battles alone, it loses. But if the region unites, it might just find a way forward. Yet for every advance in innovation or policy, another question lingers beneath the surface. Why is the Caribbean bearing this burden alone? Much of the nutrient runoff feeding the bloom originates thousands of miles away, in the agricultural basins of North America, South America, and West Africa. Yet it's the Caribbean that's raking it off the beaches, funding the cleanups, and sacrificing its ecosystems. There is no compensation, no international relief, no UN emergency declaration, only brown waves and sweat. In the next chapter, we'll follow that sweat back into government halls, where policies are made, where promises are broken, and where the blame, like the seaweed, piles up fast. Because behind every cleanup effort is a battle for accountability. And some leaders are running out of time and excuses. The political storm, before the first bulldozer scrapes the beach, before the cleanup crews roll out at dawn, before the tourists cancel their trips and the sea turtles lose their way, there are decisions, meetings, budgets, and too often inaction. The sargassum crisis has revealed not just an environmental emergency, but a deep political fracture running through the Caribbean. A fracture defined by slow responses, lack of coordination, and a failure to prepare for a crisis that comes back year after year. In early May 2025, just as satellite images confirmed an approaching superbloom, some governments were still debating whether to treat it as a priority. Dominica's environment minister publicly questioned whether it warranted a full-scale emergency response. In Trinidad and Tobago, cleanup contracts were delayed over procurement disputes. And in Haiti, where political instability has crippled nearly every institution, there were no formal coastal action plans in place at all. Meanwhile, the seaweed arrived, and it did not wait for bureaucracy. In Martinique, the government acted fast. Declaring a public health emergency, they shut down schools, deployed heavy equipment, and launched real-time air quality alerts via text message. But even there, residents questioned why the action wasn't taken earlier, after years of knowing this threat returns like clockwork. In Jamaica, tourism officials and environmental regulators clashed behind closed doors. Emails leaked to the press revealed an internal dispute. One side prioritizing optics and brand protection, the other warning of an ecological collapse if immediate intervention wasn't funded. The result? Delayed barriers, missed deadlines, millions in losses. For many Caribbean citizens, the sargassum crisis is no longer seen as a natural disaster. It is seen as a failure of leadership. Community groups across St. Lucia, Barbados, and Grenada began holding protests, small but vocal, outside ministries and municipal buildings. Their message, "We clean your mess. Where is your plan?" In one viral video, an elderly woman named Yvonne stood on the steps of the Ministry of Tourism in Bridgetown and held up a jar of decomposing sargassum. Her voice trembled with fury. You smell that? That's what I live with. That's what my grandchildren breathe. I voted for people. I did not vote for silence. Some regional leaders have acknowledged the shortfalls. At a recent CARICOM summit, the prime ministers of St. Vincent, Bahamas, and Belize proposed the creation of a Caribbean Sargassum Emergency Fund, supported by regional taxes on cruise ships and offshore developers. The proposal was met with interest, but as of now, remains unratified. International aid, too, has been slow and limited. The United Nations Environment Program, UNEP, issued statements of concern, but has not declared the situation a climate emergency. USAID and the European Union have funded some small pilot projects, research stations, biofuel testing labs, but no large-scale coastal defense initiatives. Meanwhile, many local governments fall into a cycle: reactive spending, public apologies, quick fixes, then silence until the next wave hits. This lack of long-term vision has left entire communities stranded. In Guadeloupe, fishermen formed their own task force after waiting months for promised cleanup aid. In St. Kitts, tourism workers staged a walkout when safety equipment failed to arrive, despite repeated government assurances. And in Puerto Rico, mayors of coastal towns filed joint lawsuits against the central government, accusing it of negligence, citing skyrocketing health costs and declining property values. But there are also leaders rising from below. Mayors, youth climate organizers, and coastal elders are beginning to form informal coalitions. Seaweed resistance councils, they call them. Built not on bureaucracy, but on action. They share tools, clean up data, local solutions. They teach each other. They hold workshops. They fill the void left by silence. Still, there's a looming question over every meeting, every beach, every broken promise. How many more seasons will we wait? Because the sargassum doesn't care about elections. It doesn't negotiate with ministries. It arrives, with or without permission. In the next chapter, we'll travel deeper into coastal communities and ancestral memory. Before the resorts, before the politics, before the crisis. How did the Caribbean relate to the seaweed? And could traditional knowledge hold clues for how to live with it now? Because sometimes the future begins by listening to the past. Ancestral knowledge and island innovation. Long before satellite tracking, ministerial meetings, and drone surveillance, the Caribbean people knew how to read the sea. They could smell storms days before the clouds arrived. They watched the tide rise and knew what the fish would do. They understood the currents, the heat, the color of the water. And yes, even the seaweed. What's now being called a crisis, many elders simply call a cycle. One that spiraled out of control due to human neglect, but which has always existed in gentler forms. In Belize, Garifuna fishers recall stories from their grandparents about brown ribbons in the sea. They didn't fear the sargassum. They used it. In Dominica, some older villagers still remember how small amounts of seaweed were gathered after storms and spread over cassava fields. Rich in potassium and micronutrients, it nourished the soil naturally. Women boiled it to make hair tonics, poultices for swollen joints, and even fertility brews. In St. Vincent, fishermen used it to wrap fish for smoking, the scent adding a layer of flavor no modern spice could match. And across the Lucayan Archipelago, indigenous Taino communities saw drifting seaweed as a navigation signal, tracking seasonal changes and incoming migrations. This wasn't just environmental interaction. It was relationship. But over time, that connection was broken. The knowledge wasn't passed down widely. The tourism industry paved over fishing villages. Globalization replaced natural cycles with imported solutions. And when the sargassum returned, in volumes no one had ever seen, that memory had been buried under concrete and forgotten beaches. Still, something is reawakening. Across the region, a quiet revival is underway. Not just of cleanup, but of rethinking. Not all the sargassum needs to be removed. Some of it might be reclaimed. In Barbados, permaculture farmers are blending dried sargassum with coconut husk and sugarcane waste to create a new kind of compost, one that resists pests and regenerates poor soils. In St. Lucia, artisans are experimenting with seaweed fiber as a base for biodegradable packaging and woven crafts. And in Curaçao, a grassroots lab run by a team of young women is transforming sargassum into vegan leather, used to make belts, bags, and sandals, blending science, sustainability, and fashion. These are not gimmicks. They're survival strategies. rooted in a kind of wisdom that existed before the crisis. Take the case of Elder Teresa Jean-Baptiste in Marie Galante, Guadeloupe. Now in her 80s, she spends mornings teaching children how to make boil-up tonics from dried sargassum and sea moss. But more importantly, she tells them the stories about balance, about tides, about respect. "We used to call it spirit hair," she says, fingers weaving through strands of seaweed, "because the ocean leaves it behind when it's tired. You don't curse it. You don't fear it. You find its purpose, or it will find its own." Meanwhile, at the University of the West Indies, marine scientists are partnering with local communities to create sargassum literacy programs, teaching residents how to test water toxicity, identify useful strains, and avoid areas that may harbor hazardous bacteria or heavy metals. Still, these movements face challenges. Misinformation spreads fast. Some people fear using sargassum at all, worried about contamination. Others feel betrayed, believing governments should remove every trace of it, not ask them to adapt. But adaptation is not surrender. In the Caribbean, it's ancestral technology. It's what the Maroons did in the mountains, what the Caribs did with poison arrows and cassava bread, what enslaved Africans did by planting provision grounds under the moonlight. To survive, you don't just fight nature. You learn to move with it. The question now is not simply how to remove the seaweed, but how to reclaim the narrative, how to transform a plague into a resource, a burden into a bridge between memory and innovation. In the next chapter, we'll explore that very transformation. From lab-tested biofuels to architectural solutions, a wave of green enterprise is rising from the very seaweed that once smothered hope. Could this ecological nightmare become the foundation of a new Caribbean economy? Can sargassum save the future? What if the very thing choking the Caribbean could become the key to its rebirth? It sounds almost impossible that something as foul-smelling, invasive, and toxic as sargassum seaweed could be more than just a crisis. But across labs, workshops, and farms scattered across the region, that question is being asked seriously. Can sargassum be our solution, not our curse? At first glance, it seems far-fetched. This is a substance that corrodes metal, releases hydrogen sulfide gas, and clogs ecosystems from reef to river mouth. But beneath that decay lies a chemical makeup with surprising potential, high in alginate, cellulose, potassium, and organic compounds. Sargassum is not unlike other natural materials used in fertilizers, biofuels, and bioplastics. And the Caribbean is finally taking notice. In Barbados, the government has partnered with a European renewable energy firm to pilot a sargassum to biofuel plant. The process is called anaerobic digestion. Seaweed is broken down in oxygen-free tanks, producing methane gas, which can be used to power electrical grids or cooking systems in rural areas. The early results? Promising. 1 ton of sargassum can produce enough gas to power a small clinic for several days. In Guadeloupe, scientists are experimenting with press-drying sargassum pulp into bricks, a cheap, insulating building material that's mold-resistant and biodegradable. It's being tested now in a low-income housing project along the coast. In Jamaica, entrepreneurs are producing seaweed paper, recyclable, water-resistant sheets used for packaging. One startup, Kelpie Caribbean, recently signed a deal with a rum company to create sustainable bottle labels made entirely from sargassum fiber. And in St. Kitts, local innovators have developed a low-tech way to turn dried sargassum into organic mulch, which they now use on breadfruit farms. Their yield increased 17% this season, and their soil retained moisture longer during drought spells. These are not abstract possibilities. They are real projects with measurable impact. And together, they suggest that what's piling up on Caribbean shores isn't just waste, it's untapped capital. But if there's opportunity, there's also risk. Environmental scientists warn that toxic metals sometimes absorbed by sargassum, such as arsenic or cadmium, could pose health hazards if not processed carefully. Any scaled solution must involve rigorous testing, proper regulation, and public transparency. Economists raise a different concern. Who controls the sargassum economy? If foreign companies sweep into extract, export, and profit, will the Caribbean be left with the same story it's lived for centuries? Natural resource, foreign extraction, local loss. That's why leaders and activists are calling for sargassum sovereignty, a framework where island nations own the knowledge, the industry, and the innovation built around this challenge. In Belize, coastal communities are establishing cooperatives to manage seaweed collection, with profits shared locally and decisions made democratically. In Martinique, youth-led innovation hubs are being funded by diaspora investors to keep the intellectual property in Caribbean hands. And the potential is global, as countries in West Africa, Brazil, and even Florida begin experiencing their own sargassum surges. The Caribbean, by necessity, is becoming the world's most experienced innovator in seaweed adaptation. Imagine this. Within a decade, the Caribbean could be exporting biopackaging made from sargassum, supplying clean energy innovations to other island nations, and building homes from materials born in crisis. But perhaps the greatest transformation is not industrial. It's emotional, spiritual. To take something that once symbolized decay, something that drove tourists away and made children sick, and turn it into food, fuel, shelter, and income, that is not just science. That is resilience. And the Caribbean has always known how to do that. It did it with sugarcane fields and steel pans, with resistance songs and breadfruit trees, with hurricanes and slavery and exile, and still it dances. In the next and final chapter, we return to the human story, to the communities still scraping sargassum off the beach each morning, to the grandmothers, the teachers, the divers, and the youth. Because beyond the politics, the science, and the money, it's the people who carry the Caribbean forward. A resilient people. At sunrise, the beaches still look bruised. The golden sands, once celebrated in brochures and honeymoon photos, are streaked with dark ribbons of decay. The smell, sulfur and salt and rot, still hangs in the breeze. And yet there they are, a woman in St. Lucia, sweeping seaweed from the steps of her shop before the tourists wake. A fisherman in Barbados, slicing through brown waves in a small boat, determined to reach his trap line. A group of students in Martinique, wearing gloves and bandanas, filling buckets for another morning of manual cleanup. They're not waiting for rescue. They are the rescue. Because while the world debates funding and governments draft plans, the Caribbean people continue to rise, barefoot, sunburned, proud. They rise because they've done it before. From slavery to colonialism, from hurricanes to earthquakes, from oil spills to economic collapse. This region has learned over centuries to endure what others escape. But resilience here is more than survival. It is creativity under pressure. It is community before currency. It is the refusal to surrender beauty, even when it's buried in brown tide. In Dominica, local musicians have begun composing songs about the sargassum. One calypso hook goes, "Seaweed come and seaweed go, but we stronger than what drift low." In Puerto Rico, muralists are painting coastlines with defiant art. Women wrapped in sargassum robes, turning decay into royal armor. In Haiti, where infrastructure is stretched and funding scarce, a group of teenagers turned a crisis into a classroom, building wind-powered sargassum collectors as part of their senior science project. And in the Grenadines, a small beach bar now sells sargassum mojitos, a novelty drink with seaweed syrup, lime, and local rum. Not as a joke, but as a declaration. We don't hide from our reality. We remix it. But beyond the humor, the innovation, and the hard work, there's something more powerful still. Memory. In interviews with elders from across the region, one truth echoed louder than the headlines. This isn't the first invasion. It's just the latest form. Colonial powers once came like tides. So did piracy. So did plantation systems, IMF debt, and climate injustice. Each time, the Caribbean was told to wait, to depend, to survive quietly. But now, with the sargassum, there is no time to wait and no silence to keep. The seaweed comes without warning, without mercy, but it also brings a question to every shoreline it touches. Who do we become in the face of what we cannot control? The answer in the Caribbean is clear. We become inventors. We become teachers. We become guardians of memory and builders of new futures. And maybe that's what the sargassum has always been trying to teach. That survival alone is not enough. That resistance must evolve. That the sea, like the people who live by it, can renew itself with care, with knowledge, and with courage. So the next time you hear about the sargassum crisis, don't just think of brown seaweed on white sand. Think of a region writing its next chapter. Think of a child in a mask filling buckets. Think of a turtle breaking through the tide. Think of the smell, sharp and real, and the truth it carries. Because this story doesn't end with cleanup. It ends with rebirth. And the Caribbean, the Caribbean always finds a way to rise.